Welcome to SED 584, Critical Dimensions of Free Choice Learning for Spring 2015. This is your host, Katie Stoper. I am waiting for my co-host. Nobody's calling in yet. So, let's hope that we get some folks joining us soon. Michelle Milam ought to be joining us for the certificate program, and Dr. Lisa Anthony from the University of Florida ought to be calling in as well. Hopefully they got the right time, because I know we're on a different schedule a little bit today. So, welcome to Module 4, which is getting to the point where we're wrapping up, starting to integrate some of the things we've been talking about with the physical dimensions into the other dimensions of learning that we've talked about, the social and cultural aspects. So, I'm getting a little concerned that I don't know where my co-hosts are. I'm going to try texting here. Are we able to log in? Yes, I'm online. Yes, I'm here. This technology, crazy. Lisa. All right, let's see. Hey. Calling in. Oh, there's Michelle. Michelle?
Yeah?
Michelle, is that you? Oh,
yes.
Oh, there you are. I hear you. Okay. Well, Dr. Lisa Anthony is tweeting that she is now a guest on the show. Hopefully she's calling in soon. How are you doing, Michelle?
Oh, doing well. I actually have one of your students here with me on campus. So Jenny
Excellent.
Is joining me and listening live. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Jenny. Glad you could join us. Aha, looks like we might have a caller. Putting on the microphone now. Caller, is that
Anthony?
Hey,
yep.
Welcome, everybody.
All right, great. Well, you can hear me okay.
I can hear you, Michelle.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate everyone's patience, as usual, getting started. I am in Flatonia, Texas, for those of you that don't know where that is. That's about an hour east of San Antonio and 2 hours west of Houston. So I'm on I-10 on my way from a conference to a friend's house for the evening before I'm returning to Florida this weekend. Dr. Lisa Anthony, I know, is just returning from a trip to D.C., and I'm sure Michelle has been running around the West Coast at times. But here's the beauty of the Internet. We're all here together. So, as I said, yeah, this is Module 4 of 5, so we're coming up to the end of our 10-week course on the physical dimensions of free choice learning. And, yeah, our guest today is Dr. Lisa Anthony. So one of the things we've been talking about in this module is how to make your signage and exhibit labels kind of our particular examples in the reading, how to do some real usability tests with signage. And I asked Dr. Lisa Anthony to join us because she'll tell you a little bit about her background, but she does usability with a lot of touchscreen surfaces. Her background is computer science. And one of the things we used to talk about a little bit in this course was a little more technology-based user interface design. And I thought she would be a great person to tell us a little bit about that, since we're not really talking about it in the reading. And she happens to be one of my collaborators, and we're going to also talk a little bit about some work we were doing at Hatfield last summer that kind of is trying to really marry both of our interests in free choice education and computer science and usability. So, Lisa, do you want to introduce yourself, give us a little bit of your background, your degrees, where you've worked, and what your research interests are today? Oh. Lisa? Oh, did we lose her? Michelle, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Can't hear Lisa, though. Lisa, maybe try hanging up and calling back in, if you can still hear us. Okay. Oh, the caller dropped. Like, so hopefully she'll call back in a second. Well, while she does that, Michelle, do you, oh, wait, here she is. Lisa, you back?
Yeah, sorry, I just got disconnected, so I missed what you were saying. I apologize for that.
That's okay. I was just saying that, well, I don't know where you dropped out of the conversation. I was about to invite you to introduce yourself and tell us about your background, but I introduced where we were in the module in terms of usability and signage and how we used to talk a little more about technology and digital sorts of usability, but that more of your interest and not something we necessarily cover in the course these days, so that's why I invited you to speak. So why don't you start with just, you know, your academic background and your work you've done. I know you've done some work in industry, and then your current research interest.
Sure, thanks. And thanks again for having me on the show, or for the class, either way. I don't know what language you normally use. You know. But so what I do, I'm an assistant professor at University of Florida in the computer science department, and I started off with getting my bachelor's and master's in computer science at Drexel University in Philadelphia. So that was my first love, was computer science in general, just being able to build technology and try to build things that were sort of cool to use and fun, and I just got a really big kick out of getting to program things and seeing the end result. And as I was studying, you know, in undergrad, I studied human-computer interaction as a sub-area of computer science and got really interested in the way that human-computer interaction emphasizes building technology for different users by considering what perceive and act, and building technology for different contexts and specific contexts rather than just a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, or just focusing on the back end and the technology, but thinking about how to design it so that the interface flows smoothly for the users, kind of meets their expectations, helps them get through doing their task in an efficient way. So I got really excited about that area. And I did undergraduate research while I was at Drexel, but it was more focused on, I did some artificial intelligence research. And so when I went to grad school, I decided to go to grad school to get to work on more cutting-edge technology. I was really interested in the future of user interfaces, how people were going to interact with futuristic technologies like ubiquitous computing. What will we do when every surface in the house is smart, or every object in the house is smart? What would those interactions look like? So I went to grad school at Carnegie Mellon University, and I got my PhD in human-computer interaction, which is in the School of Computer Science. And what was a big strength of that program was the focus on three sort of legs of HCI. The computer science and technology side was one aspect, but equally important were considered things like the design aspect, so looking at the history of design as a discipline in terms of how to go about the process of designing things, and psychology and social science and understanding people and cognition and perception, like I was mentioning. So after grad school, I wasn't at all sure that I wanted to be an academic. So if you have students who are in your class who are feeling that way, that's completely normal. And I spent some time at Lockheed Martin working on advanced user interfaces and advanced research projects for the government. Research interest, but much more applied and you know, focused on a specific context of use, obviously relevant to DARPA's mission. I guess I missed interacting with students, and I missed the sort of more freedom you have, academic freedom you have to do fundamental projects, fundamental research in academia. So I did a postdoc at UMBC as a way to transition back to academia, and here I am. This is the end of my second year at University of Florida. You guys still there?
Great. Yeah, this is Michelle. That's a wonderful introduction. I don't know if Katie muted herself, or hopefully we didn't lose Katie from the call.
Okay.
It was wonderful. I really like your point, too. A lot of our master students, obviously, are the more academic-focused and here to enhance their theoretical background and frameworks. But I don't know if Katie told you, this is a radio show for both that program and our non-credit program for professionals who work already in some kind of informal institution and just kind of want more background and approach. So I think what you said about that bridge between being in industry and being back in academia is very relevant for a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay, so. Great. That context helps for sure. I think it's good, you know, I always find in my classes now that students get very excited when I can tell them stories about applying the methods and the theories that we learn about with respect to human-computer interaction in their projects based on my research, my experience in industry. So that, I think, is a helpful thing that I spent time doing.
That's great. And, of course, that's where our students are right now at this point in the term, is that they are just all submitting proposals for their prototyping study. So, could reflect on for us, like, what your process looks like for prototyping?
Sure, yeah. So Katie had mentioned, you know, mentioning my research interest. So I'll tell you that I do this work in the context of building natural user interfaces, especially for children. Natural user interfaces is a blanket term kind of used in human-computer interaction today to refer to non-keyboard and mouse-based interactions like speech, touch, gesture, things that are a little more futuristic, get you away from you can use them in mobile contexts, you can use them, it's going to be more ubiquitous, and it's going to be useful in more contexts. And what we see is that typical approaches don't work as well for kids. They've got, you know, they're still developing cognitively, and their motor skills are still developing, so our technologies don't actually work as well. And so I work on both building those technologies, but also prototyping through involving users in the process. So that's probably the most relevant piece, and the reason Katie asked me to come and talk to the class is this process that we follow, we call user-centered design, and it's a standard approach in human-computer interaction. And in fact, in industry and technology industry, this will be a job that someone will have. They're called UX UI. For example, user interface, user experience. Those might be their title. And their job will be really to lead this prototyping process from user research all the way to prototype ready to get built to production level specs. So typically this idea of user-centered design is to consider the needs of the users early and often throughout the process. It's very iterative. You're going to start off with very open-ended. You know, you might have an idea of the kind of thing you want to build or the kind of thing you want to support, but you might not know a lot about how the users interact, you know, already interact in that space. What kinds of things do they already use in their daily lives to do those tasks that you're looking to support? Or what kinds of things, or is it completely new and you have to come up with a brand new blue sky concept? And so you go talk to users, people in your targeted user group, other stakeholders. Since I work with kids a lot in the prototyping we do, we might often have additional stakeholders like teachers or parents, whoever sort of is going to have a stake in what this eventual product looks like. And so you would do this in terms of focus groups. We often have like an open-ended focus group type of discussion. I'll bring a couple questions to kind of start the discussion off. And you want to do some brainstorming with your users, try to get them thinking creatively. So you have the ability to go beyond, think outside the box based on the info that you're getting from them. So it's really, I think, the job of the user experience person or the research, you know, maybe the user researcher is this phase of the process, is to interpret. You're going to get a lot of different kinds of input from all the different people that you talk to through your focus groups. In fact, you might get people who completely disagree with each other, and it's your job as the user in a way that you can see beyond the specifics of what they're saying to the motivation of why they're saying it and how you can sort of balance some of the trade-offs that you might have heard them talk about and things like that. So this is a lot of discussion, a lot of you take a lot of notes during this, or you record it, and then you go back with your team and you look, you basically go through everything you learned. You write down everything, you know, every little nugget that somebody said, and then you you make these post-it notes. We call it affinity diagramming. You write everything, every little nugget on a post-it note. Then you fill up your wall with all these post-it notes. Somebody starts by taking the first post-it note. They walk up to the wall. They put it somewhere. They take another post-it note and label it with a category. So what is something that's being expressed here? What's the value or the need or the user priority that's kind of coming out through this quotation from the user? And then you have all your other post-it notes, and you take the next post-it note and you say, well, is it related to that post-it note? Is it expressing the same value? Because if it is, then you stick it right next to that one. Otherwise, you make a new post-it note, a new category note that expresses a new value, and you put that in another spot on the wall, and you put all the notes that are around that topic up on the wall. And the power of this method is that it's a very organic way of seeing the themes emerge. So you're not necessarily trying to go top down and say, here are the themes that emerge, and here are the themes we thought emerged, and here's all the data that supports us. But instead, you're kind of allowing the data to help you organically come up with these themes. And that really helps you sort of keep yourself honest. You're not putting too much of your own bias as to what you want. So that's kind of like the first part of the process. I don't know if you normally, you know, have questions, or if you want me to keep going, or you want me to pause.
Lisa, I just want to...
Oh, there's Katie. Good.
I was going to say that, Lisa, that's a perfect stopping point. I was going to say, yeah, that's really great description of, I think, the process of coding and really learning from the data and letting things emerge from the data that we really want to emphasize with our students, especially for their final project. They won't be working in teams, but they may very well use the post-it note design. And I think that's a pretty cool way to do it. I haven't physically done post-it notes that way, but one thing I might want to step back a second before you keep going, you mentioned you sort of start from what you might want to design for someone, kind of sounding like you start designing out of the blue. And one difference that our folks are going to do is that they're going to start with something that they see as a problem that is like preventing learning from happening, and so, or that they think is contributing to the problem of learning or some outcome that, you know, not happening that they want to happen in their environment. So, for example, one of the students mentioned that there's at the entrance to a particular institution she's aware of, you can go kind of two different ways, and there's, you know, 90% of people go to the right, and very few of them ever get to use the path on the left. And so she was going to, you know, see if she could start, in, you know, putting some signage and trying a couple of different temporary things that would allow people, hopefully, to notice and make use of that side a little more. So I don't know if you want to talk about how often you might come, and this is maybe more in your industry background, how often you might come from something from that sort of standpoint where something's already designed and you realize there's a problem and you try and, like, maybe iteratively collect data again and try and solve it.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think that's a really important point. I'm glad you brought that up because I don't want to give the impression that sometimes it's true that there might be, you might be trying to innovate or create a new brand new service But it should always be motivated by some breakdown in an existing process or product. It's going to be much more likely to be something that's used by people and adopted by people if it's something that they think they need, or that you can convince them that they need based on your observations of how where the breakdowns are. So I would say very important to consider, like you say, where are the breakdowns in an existing process or task or product, and then you can start from that. But you'll still want to do this user research process, because you may not be able to fully intuit the reasons that there's the breakdowns without, you know, getting this information. So instead of, maybe your focus group's not blue sky, but you're talking about the existing product, you're asking about breakdowns, you're having them walk through different use cases of the scenario that you're interested in. A problem oriented design is really, I think, a stronger approach in general. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's perfect. That's great. I don't know if there's more to the process that you want to go into, or at some point maybe we could start giving some concrete examples about what you and I were doing last summer at Happy in that sort of way. So
yeah. So I was gonna move now to the prototyping phase. Basically, once you've done your user research, you've characterize the themes that you've seen emerge. This is going to lead you to coming up with different ideas about user needs. You know, maybe if you're talking about designing for a case where there's already a breakdown, a problem in a product in place and there are breakdowns, you're going to have exposed the breakdowns, and you might even have ideas from the users on ways to make it better. And then as a team, if it's yourself as a designer, you'll brainstorm around these themes to kind of come up with a basic design concept. And the conceptual design process is really informal. It's a lot of sketching. It's a lot of, you know, kind of getting a lot of ideas out there on paper or on paper, and trying to generate as many ideas as you can, because then you're going to take a different lens. You're going to go back through the ideas and sort of figure out, okay, well, this idea is addressing this user need or this combination of themes from the data, and maybe you come up with ways to combine the concepts, or like maybe the three top strongest concepts, and then you're going to actually go about prototyping and showing them to users and getting their feedback. You know, one of the things we did last summer, we went in to Hatfield Marine Science Center to try to get some ideas about how people might want to use touch-enabled science exhibits on, like, touch screens, like touch tables or touch walls, how they might want to engage with scientific data in a way that, obviously, our goal was so that they would learn something from this experience. But the first step is to just get them using it and sticking around long enough to learn something, right, as opposed to sort of walking up and then walking away when it doesn't do what they expect. So that was, I guess, the purpose of our visit. And we had some really simple prototypes that we just wanted to see, based on some existing tools that were already out there. We used Google Earth as one of the tools, and then we mocked up a very simple interface where people could just kind of, in a separate a separate prototype where people could just kind of flip back and forth between different visualizations of scientific data to try to get at, you know, the kinds of gestures really at a low level that they would want to perform. You know, are they trying to zoom in? Are they trying to get information about any specific areas on the screen? What are their questions they're asking themselves? Trying to get the system to help them answer, and how are they going about doing that? And so we had mocked these prototypes up. They're really simple. There doesn't have to be a lot of smarts in the back end. You know, you can get away with a lot of high-level abstract prototypes. We call them low fidelity, where they don't really look a lot like a final product, but they kind of show just the main interactive features, and they're good enough for some simple testing. And then we kind of sat back and tried to watch the people as they interacted. We interviewed some of them afterwards and ask them questions that were designed to prompt them for more about why they were trying certain gestures, why they were, what information they were seeking, what needs were they trying to satisfy by interacting with that piece of that platform, that prototype. And then the goal, and we're still working on this part of the research, but the goal of that, you know, process is to then take the information we learn, what did we see them doing, which seemed successful and which didn't seem successful. Can we understand more about what paths are going to lead to the most rewarding experience for the users? Then we would prototype that. You know, we would modify our prototype and iterate on it with to make it slightly more robust, to make it slightly higher fidelity. You know, you're kind of converging towards your design idea in that model. You're kind of starting from a really abstract concept, and each iteration you refine it to more and more detail until, with user feedback all along the way, until you end up with something, you know, that's getting really close to a final version of at least the interaction part, you know, what that interaction is going to feel like. In the technology world, you often would do this without all the necessary back-end stuff. Like if you're going to do a mobile app, you know, a real mobile app that's on the App Store is going to have a lot of back-end things like client-server databases, security and privacy and logging in, and you don't need any of that in your prototyping phases. So that's kind of what I'm getting at when I'm talking about getting from lower fidelity to higher fidelity. And then there's even a step beyond that where you would then, after the final prototyping phase, build the actual production level technology, if that makes sense.
Yes, Lisa, thanks. It absolutely does. And I think you actually made some really good points to emphasize for the students that these do not have to be fancy, you know, high quality production signs. You know, something that you print out in Microsoft Word would be totally sufficient for this project. So please do not think you need to create and spend a lot of time, you know, designing. You just need something that you can get people kind of talking about and using in a mock-up, and that's really great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I actually want to piggyback off that and add a clarification. It's actually a part of the user-centered design process is to make sure you don't show too high fidelity of a product, of a prototype, too early, because what that does is it makes it look more finished to the people you're getting feedback on it from, and then they're much less likely to give you significant feedback that they might have given you about how, you know, your maybe the whole organization is off or the whole workflow it feels off to them, but because it looks really polished, they're going to tend to give you much more, small tweaks of feedback here and there because it looks done. So that's another reason to actually start off with very low fidelity looking prototypes.
That's really interesting, and I'm going to tell you, you know, bring up again something that you and I have talked about, particularly in your work, but I think it's exactly relevant in ours as well, is that it's, you know, sometimes people don't know what to envision, you know, or certainly when they're like wandering around the museum, you know, they're not really in the mindset to maybe think big. And so, you know, the reason to actually start with a prototype or a problem, like you say, again, is just people may not have any clear idea, but if you give them something to work with, much, it's almost like it's easier to edit a draft than it is to write the first words of your proposal, right? So
yeah, absolutely. And great. We call those in the technology, you know, in the user experience world that I'm talking about, those kinds of prototypes would be called design probes. So they would actually be things you would bring in. They might even be complete straw men. You know, you have no even work remotely at all, but they get the conversation going, and it's a way to ground and make context for the users that, like you said, it's going to be hard for them to just sort of come up. They're not used to designing. They're not used to this kind of process, so you're giving them some starting point. It produces a lot more productive sessions.
Great. Well, I know we do have one student on the line, and I know, Jenny, not to put you on the spot, but you were kind of struggling with a context
I don't know if you were struggling so much about the idea of prototyping, but maybe you have a comment or a question here you want to jump in with?
Yeah, so almost late August.
Oh, we still have no
I can't really hear.
We weren't sure if you were talking to us or not because we were getting some feedback. So we are still here.
Sorry. I was just saying that since we do have Jenny on the line and she was struggling, I know, with sort of a context or question of what to do. I don't know if she's gotten to the point where maybe, you know, in the course of this discussion or in her thoughts, you know, she might have a comment or question about the process and what she's kind of thinking about doing for her final project that she might be interested in sharing.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, hi, Lisa. Nice to talk to you again, first off.
Hi.
Just thinking a little bit more as I was walking through Hatfield and thinking a little bit differently from, because I've been doing the touch table quite a bit over the last 2 years, of getting some experience in doing other things, and more or less along the lines of like content and signage and things like that, and just noticing, you know, we have such a distribution of exhibits at Hatfield, whether it's live animals or technology, but I don't know if you can comment on some of the things that you do just to get like a baseline first to even start, and I know you mentioned like talking about focus groups and things like that, but I was thinking more along, you know, using some of our technology with the camera system we have set up to just kind of look at if, you know, the particular exhibit I might think about doing is a rockfish live animal display, and just even noticing if people are stopping at that exhibit at all first to find out if there's an issue or a problem. So I don't know if, you know, some of the stuff that you were talking about is, you know, going from to the user themselves and finding out where the challenges are, I think relates also to the museum spaces, like first finding out where there may be an issue. And it's always challenging our assumptions because what we might think is an issue might not be at all. So I just appreciate some of your comments on that.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. There's a lot of different methods for different phases of design. My students, I teach a class on inner user experience design, which basically covers this process I'm telling you about. And the first thing that I have them do when they start their projects, you know, I usually give them a context. So you have the same kind of thing where it's the museum context. So an environment where they should go into this environment and try to find some breakdowns or some places where things could be improved. And so what I'll have them do is, you know, go there, let's say it's a coffee shop or let's say it's a parking garage, and kind of, you know, observe, sit there, see what the interactions are taking place, maybe take some notes, write down ideas they have as they're watching people try to do tasks. They might not actually have to talk to anyone to find those problems or to have them jump out at them. And then we go in the next phase, they would talk to people to kind of dig in more depth to what was going on when the problem was observed. But yeah, to even sort of find a problem to tackle, I think you have a little more of a wider net at the beginning where you might just sort of, like you said, watch the cameras. What do you notice about how people approach this exhibit or don't approach the exhibit? Does it seem like people with kids tend to walk over there or not? Does it seem like, you know, what patterns are you seeing in how people are doing, you know, interacting in the space that might point to a breakdown? Is there a time when somebody looks like they want to do something and they change their mind? Well, what caused them to change their mind? Does it look like they tried to do something and it wasn't successful? You know, that's obviously a clear evidence of a breakdown that you might choose as a problem to solve. So yeah, I think observation and data gathering in the beginning, when you're looking for something that's a problem, you know, you don't want to go in with a preconceived notion of what you're going to do, because for both those reasons we talked about, you don't know what was causing those breakdowns, but you might not even really have the experience yet to know what the breakdowns were in the first place. So that's why the observation step's important.
Yes, thank you.
Great. sorry, I'm muting and unmuting because I have to be sitting next to the door, which has this fancy air conditioning system that every time it opens, like, comes on, and so that may be the big fan that you guys have been hearing. I hope that's getting better.
I thought it was a paper shredder.
It sounds kind of like that. So, yeah, thanks, Jenny. That's really helpful to push the thoughts in that direction. And, you know, I haven't been hearing any feedback yet from folks that they're having a problem deciding that, besides Jenny, who I talked with. But I'm hoping as people are sending in their ideas this week and, you know, posting on the discussion board, they're starting to learn from each other. And Nanette did ask whether I was going to give feedback on your project and that's on your proposal. You know, absolutely, I'm going to give feedback at least on the write-ups and how to do that. I'm not going to necessarily critique your idea because that's one of the things that I think, you know, in consult with the students, that's how we set up the class, but we really want you to build this community and work together as much as you can, given that this is a distance course. You know, Dr. Anthony, Lisa has talked about, you know, how she works in groups to do coding a lot, and she and I and an undergraduate have been working hard to develop a coding scheme for our data. So I really want you to get the sense of really struggling through a problem in a real way, in an authentic way, and not like expecting there to be an expert to come and be like, yes, this is a fabulous idea. It's more about, you know, making sure that you're set up to do the process right and that sort of thing. But that said, if there's anybody on the line or on the chat room that I don't see yet that might have questions, we've still got about 20 minutes, so you're free to call in and chat in. Oh, there goes the fan again. Paper shredder. Ah, the joys of the internet and Western Texas. Michelle, I didn't know if you had any questions from your students. I know they're often a little further behind in the process, or if there's anything else from the course that might have come up that we might want to ask Lisa.
I saw that a few of my students turned in proposals already. I have not looked at them besides just helping guide one student who, like Jenny, was just kind of hung up on the initial steps of, you know, is this feasible to do for this course and whatnot. But just hearing Lisa talk, I think one question that I thought of that may be applicable for other people too is when you're going through this prototyping and you go in very open-ended, you don't have all of your plans set out from the beginning, and you show people your first prototype and you get feedback and from people, you change your prototype based on that feedback. And then what if your next group kind of wants you to revert back to what you had? So kind of going to like this different opinions because you're not necessarily asking the same people every time. And how do you, as a developer, handle that? How do you ultimately make a choice of who should I listen to and which opinion should I put weight towards?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's probably the nugget which most defines the art of user experience design, because it is an art. You know, I mentioned the idea of translating between what the users are saying and what you can use to turn that into an actual prototype, because you are going to hear contradictions, or at least on the surface, they'll seem like contradictions. You are going to hear somewhat different priorities. You know, to some groups of users, feature X is the most important, but to other groups of users, feature Y is the most important. And how do you navigate those trade-offs? And I think without one, you know, the more problems, the more design you do, the more you start to be sensitive to the different, to hearing the nuances in what your users are saying and where there's actually common threads, even when it sounds like they're saying different things. And the way you can kind of start to build that experience up is by going really explicitly through these kinds of situations. If you're getting feedback that seems like people are saying you should go, you know, you should have it like this, and the way you had it, I mean, that's the way you had it before, and you changed it, you know, because of other users' feedback. The nuance that I would say you should try to be listening to there is, what is it that made the original group give you the feedback in that direction? What was their motivation? What was the reason, you know, they might not be able to articulate this to you directly, and that's where the translation comes in, where you're trying to listen for what's underneath what they're saying. Is it that it was confusing? Is it that it wasn't where they expected it to be? Is it that it doesn't match, you know, their conceptual model of the language? The terminology you're using is different from the terminology they understand. They might not be able to say something so concrete like, I don't understand this word that you use, because there's also some ego involved, there's social pressure that it is going to happen during your interactions with people. And so you need to try to listen to what's going on. Sometimes you can ask probing questions diplomatically, you know, trying to find out whether your interpretation of what they're saying is accurate. And then the second piece I would say is trying to make sure you talk to enough different kinds of people to span the range of your target users. So you might find that seems contradictory, but if you look at the types of users that are giving you the feedback, it's like all the moms are saying this, but all the dads are saying this, you know? And so how can you take that into account in how you design your product to consider different perspectives? We usually go by what's called the 80-20 rule. We say, you know, 80% of the feedback, 80% of the things that are wrong with your prototype will be found by 20% of users. So you're going to start hearing less and less, you know, new things, new nuggets, the more people you talk to. But you do need that initial base of, let's say, 5 people that kind of span the ranges of what your target users are, in order to hear the problems in the first place and to begin to be able to do that translation and interpretation step. So I hope that kind of helps point your students towards some strategies of how to consider what might happen there. In a really concrete case, if you do get that kind of feedback where it seems like people suggest changes that kind of revert you back to a previous version, and you really aren't sure how to dig underneath the motivation there, you might just try having, you know, the next time you take your prototypes out, having both and getting people to give you feedback on the comparison, you know, directly. And so kind of giving yourself that ability to ask the same people at least about a couple versions when you're really feeling lost.
That's great advice. Thank you for the whole response.
No problem.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, and I'm impressed again about how much our fields overlap in this, and you know, and use different terms, but you know, have maybe similar goals and look at different pieces of the experience. Like, to go back to what Lisa and I were doing last summer, you know, I'm really interested in how people are making meaning from the data visualizations, and Lisa's interested more, if I get this right, in actually how they're using, you know, how they're interacting and how that shapes their experience. Again, we both kind of are prototyping and using similar methods, and so it's great to hear from different fields and different perspectives in the same way. We do have a question on the chat. So one of our students is going to be looking at a touchscreen map that is orienting people to part of her museum. I believe she's still going to look at the Bishop Museum in Hawaii. Not that that makes that much difference, but she said, you know, she's discovered that there's a lot of incorrect information within the map piece itself. Basically, some exhibits have been replaced and changed, but haven't been, those updates haven't been reflected in the map. She wants to look at how people use it as an orientation, like, first in the building. She's not sure whether she should try and correct that basic information, or
before she starts her observations, or just go with what it is, you know, what it's like, and go from there. I guess my instinct would be to think about what is she going to be able to correct ultimately. I mean, if the map is horribly designed, you know, in general, it doesn't really probably matter if a couple of things are wrong, but there may be some more subtle issues that actually the touchscreen part I mean, you should have some experience on, Lisa.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good question, and there's a couple of factors that I think to consider in making a decision here. You know, one is, as Katie points out, it kind of depends a little bit on the scope of these issues. I mean, if you already know that this map cannot be used for wayfinding or navigation or planning out one's visit, then it, you know, we have a little like an adage we say in user experience design, you know, if you already know the problem exists and you put it in front of a user, you're not going to learn anything new because they're going to tell you exactly what you already knew. So if you know that it's, you know, that's something that's unusable, I question whether you would get any data that would be useful for your research question or for your question of design. And so the second thing to think about is maybe, like Katie said, if it's only a few small issues here or there, it doesn't really impact the overall experience, you know, let's say more than 10 or 20%, then you have to consider what your question is, you know, how directly related to the question that you're trying to solve or answer, a problem that you're trying to solve, are these mistakes, you know, In this case, it really sounds like they're very directly related, and I would say it might be hard to separate out the mistakes from the question. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you just kept getting a lot of data basically telling you, well, the map has mistakes on it, and so that caused me some trouble. You know, and you have to just say to yourself, that's not necessarily going to be worth your time. Now, there's the flip side of it, which is you might not have the control over fixing the maps. I mean, sometimes these are technology-based artifacts, which are, you know, either they're institutional where there's some kind of hierarchy and you're not able to get in there and make a change because of, you know, institutional pressure. They have this map and it's not, can't be fixed. Or you have technology limitations where you don't have the skills to fix it. And then in that case, you kind of are stuck, I think, getting to the point where you're going to encounter a lot of the same problems that you already can predict. But it's going to have to be a trade-off with how much control you have over how much you think that's going to impact the experience. A concrete suggestion I could make is, you know, it's not a perfect solution, but, well, actually, one it's making me think of even a third option, but one thing you could try is maybe on the touchscreen overlaying, you know, a piece of clear cellophane of some kind that doesn't interfere with the touch-enabled properties of the surface, but kind of slightly changes the map in a way that, you know, is a little more up-to-date. And then that led me to think about the idea of paper prototyping. So you may have people split their time between interacting with the touch-enabled display that already exists with its mistakes and all, knowing that you're going to get a lot of data about the mistakes more than about maybe the question you're trying to solve. But you can also have them in the other half of their time interact with a paper prototype, which is just what it sounds like. It doesn't have to look very fancy. It's just basically you sketch out, you know, a mock-up on paper of what the app looks like. And as people touch the areas on the mock-up, that would be touch enabled on the surface, you play the part of the computer and replace that part of the screen with whatever new information would have been displayed with, like, another piece of paper, you know, gets laid over that corner, or maybe the whole screen changes, so you put another map down, or a pop-up menu appears. You can have a little post-it note that puts that pop-up menu in that spot where they touched. So there's methods of using paper prototypes where, you know, this goes back to what we were talking about with low fidelity prototypes. They don't look at all like the final version. They don't even really feel like it because it's a touch, you know, paper versus a screen. But it's amazing how much data you can get from that kind of interaction. It really puts people in the context of walking through, you know, the steps it takes to accomplish a goal. And they can tell you, this feels weird, or I don't know what to touch next to do the thing I want to do, or it seems like this went backwards. I would have expected this to happen, and this other thing happened instead. So you can get a lot of data from, you know, by what technology you can actually provide.
Great. Yeah, I think that's right on. And if you missed the discussion of low fidelity prototypes, Amber, that was in the beginning, and that's absolutely what you're welcome to do for this project. You commented that you're getting trained to actually change it, some basic stuff. But I think, yeah, it comes down to what kind of question you're trying to solve. Is the problem with the way they're interacting with it on the touchscreen? Is it with the bigger layout of the map itself? Is it maybe with where the map and touchscreen is? Because just like when we talk with labels, are they the right height for people to use? Maybe it's not that the touchscreen is a problem itself. Maybe it's that it's at the wrong height for people. Maybe it's in an awkward spot, you know. So those are things that you could easily, you know, prototype, assuming you can move the thing. But even if you can't move it, you go maybe and stand in a new spot with it, for example, or with a paper prototype in a new spot, and test it out that way. And then the issues of the couple of exhibits being a little bit out of date are not a problem. And the power of that is, if that's the real problem, you don't have to worry so much about the technology design, maybe, and you can say, look, it's not that the touchscreen, you know, interface is bad. It's just in a bad spot. So I don't know if you've identified what kind of problem, you know, in there you want to look at, but that may be part of the crux of your question too. Well, we're coming down to the last few minutes of this, and I want to be sure, I keep running out of time. I'm getting better as this go along. I want to be sure and thank Dr. Lisa Anthony from the University of Florida Computer and Information Sciences and Engineering Department. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. We just say computer science for short.
Right, right. Well, I think it's cool that you're housed with the engineering department, and that's sort of a different, or in the engineering college and things. That's sort of a different thing, but, you know, another question for another day. But I really want to thank you for being here and providing such excellent perspective and overlap on things we're doing. I'll let you all know that in 2 weeks we will have another radio show. We might be able to get Dr. Laura Good, who was not able to be with us a little bit earlier, to pop in for a few minutes, but we'll also just be discussing final projects. I really encourage students to be able to make some time to post questions beforehand for that one. Michelle and I will really try and answer some specific last questions about the course for you. And do some wrap-up of what we've talked about this term. I can't believe how fast it's gone, that it's already 8 weeks in. Now that I've gotten sort of that last little housekeeping out of the way, we can turn back to the discussion. Lisa, I don't know if you have other thoughts that have sort of come to mind as we've talked a little more and you've gotten a little more to know about the course, or if there's something you wanted to add, or if Michelle, anybody else has questions? Nope, dead silence. Oh, there we go.
I was going to say I could certainly say some more things, but I thought I'd wait and see if anyone had questions. But otherwise, I certainly could think of a few more tidbits.
There are no questions on my end, so go ahead and share your tidbits.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, great. So one of the things I wanted to call out from what Katie was saying is about the idea of presence and context and how important it is in doing your prototyping exercises or activities. Because as much as you, because going back to what we said about people having a hard time kind of envisioning new technology or envisioning a completely open new possibility or even a new version that you're not really showing them concretely in front of them, it's also similarly difficult. It can be easier, actually, I should say, if you put them in the context where they'll be interacting with that either that product or that technology. So if you know, actually, like Katie was saying, walking around the museum saying, okay, if it was here, because then you have the context of the whole rush of the exhibits, and you're in the space, and there's a lot of benefit that that gives to how much people are able to sort of put themselves in the mindset, because they are, you know, right there physically where they would be. And so I would say don't discount that as being valuable activity. You know, make yourself go there, get out into the world and see how you can get feedback in context where it will actually be, you know, the point that it will actually be used. And the other thing I would say is that the idea of getting prototype and focusing on just getting the ideas out there. One of the first things everyone tells me in my class is that they can't draw. So they don't want to do their paper prototypes because they can't draw. Well, you don't have to be able to draw like Picasso to sketch out a prototype, right? And if you want tools and tips to try to make it look a little, if you really have horrendous writing and you're like a doctor writing a prescription and no one can read it, then maybe, you know, maybe use a stencil or something. But, you know, the point is just to get your ideas on paper, and the worse it looks, the more feedback you're going to get. So don't let a fear of sketching or drawing keep you from trying out these methods.
That's great. Those are really important tips that I think, again, you know, I do some work with, like, thinking about experts, and I always forget, like, some of these little things that I've just internalized over the years of doing this, but all these funny little things that can hang people up. And so that's great that you emphasize that with your classes, and I'm glad that you really brought those up. And your first point especially is, I think, I promise I didn't get her, you know, ask her to say that, everybody, but that's actually the crux of what we're doing in this course, is we are absolutely examining how the physical context affects, you know, everything you do. And your point is exactly right. Like, computer scientists could spend all their time doing testing in the lab, you know, but the first time that you took your cell phone outside, you know, you obviously were like, oh, I can't see anything on this screen because it's too bright, and laptops and all that sort of thing, right? And so if you're not in the place where it's actually going to be, especially any of you who are doing outdoor learning, you got to test it on a rainy day and on a sunny day and on a windy day and think about all of those things. And that's really where I think, you know, our experience in museums and tangible spaces and as researchers, we become really valuable collaborators with a lot of people as well. And so, again, our expertise can complement a lot of different fields and the work that they're trying to do, and ultimately benefit, you know, all of our learners that we're interested in working with. So Amber says, thanks so much for the vote of confidence in using the very basics. And she also thanked you for the great suggestions, Lisa. And
okay, no problem.
Yeah, so... Geez, I don't want to say that we've run out of things to talk about a little bit early, but I'm afraid if we start something, we're going to run out of time. So we obviously could talk all day on a lot of these issues, and I'll just encourage students to really embrace this assignment and have some fun with it. But, you know, the idea is to really get in there and get down and dirty and test things out, as we've been doing throughout the course. So, Michelle, I don't know if you have any parting words? Oh.
Yes, we do. We have a question from this end. Jenny wants clarification as to when the master's student's final project is actually due.
The final project? Or the
when is their final report?
I'm going to have to check the syllabus and when the grades are due, and I will get to you. Can you tell me, is there a place where there's confusion that I've put two different things that I can make sure and look up and clarify?
No, just no exact date. So just maybe it's okay. Point of reference. You know, we end in week 10, and the week after that is finals week here on campus. So maybe just to clarify at this point, they may have some time before the end or after the end of week 10. So
that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yes. And of course, as always, if you're having problems and need a little bit of an extension, please let me know ahead of time. But like it will be during final week. Okay. Got to wrap up for this week. You guys know where to email me. Thank you all so much again to Dr. Lisa Anthony. And we'll see you on the internet. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I got to get back on the road. Lisa, really, thanks so much. Oh, there you went. Okay.
I did stay. Yes.